Now, about some of the issues that came up while you were chairman.
Well, one of the issues, you see, we had that tremendous inflow of students. And we had extreme difficulty getting competent instructors to take care of all, particularly our laboratory sections. And, of course, we, during the war period, we didn't have very much money to do things with, and we were sort of cramped financially. We had about three divisions. We had our shop activity, we had our machine design, and we had our steam and gas engineering division. We had appointed a faculty man for each one of these divisions, so we operated as a department with small groups operating. That's done pretty largely today, too, because the machine design people, they were distinct from the steam and gas people, and the shop people were in between. Mm-hmm. And we had a very strong personality in the department. Pat Highland, who incidentally came to university the same day I did, he had very positive and definite conclusions about things, and sometimes he caused a little irritation among other people, but we were just able to get along very well by cooperation. And then we discovered we had, I suppose you'd call him a communist on our staff at one time.
Oh, who was that?
I don't recall his name right offhand. But he was discovered tearing down the signs that the ROTC were putting up on the bulletin boards. And we found out about him. Professor Highland knew all about it. The FBI knew all about him. And, of course, as soon as we discovered what was happening and he was here, he was dispensed with and he moved to Milwaukee. And we had another case, a very brilliant staff member who turned out to be a member of the Communist Party of China. He turned out, though, to be one of the very best teachers we've ever had.
Do you recall his name?
His name was H.S.U.
What was the last name?
H.S.U. was his last name. Sue.
How do you spell that?
H-S-U. That was his name. I don't recall his first name now. I have a newspaper article at home about him.
But the Communist Party of China. That is curious.
The reason people, I think, noticed him, he always seemed to have a tremendous amount of money. He always was quite profuse in spending money and building houses and buying automobiles and that sort of thing.
Now, did he stay?
No, he departed very suddenly.
But voluntarily?
No, I wouldn't say that. Unless he just got a jump ahead of the university. He's a brilliant individual. He had a fine family. After he departed, I think the family stayed here. The kids went to the School of Music, I believe. He's now in Washington, D.C. And when he left here, I tried to get a job for him. And I finally did get one for him. Down in West Virginia. Well, sometime after he'd been at West Virginia, I met one of my friends from the university and asked him what happened to Sue. Said they didn't know. He just disappeared suddenly and nobody knew where he went or what he did. And the next place, I think he turned up was at the University of Maryland. Well, I think Kurt Wendt had a thorough investigation made, and the man did nothing illegal. He was a purchasing agent for the government of China. That's the reason he had so, so very, very much money.
Oh. Well, now, why was, would it have been that the university discouraged the presence here of somebody, a member of the Communist Party?
Well, I don't think it was known that he was a member of the Communist Party, but the general supposition was he was sort of a spy on for the Chinese government, which we could never prove. When he was at MIT, he had some trouble, too.
Now, when was he there? Before he came here?
I think it was at MIT before he came here. One Christmas time, after he'd been gone about 10 years, I got a big box at Christmas time. It came from a place up in Washington. And inside was a card with his name on it. And that's the only thing I've heard from him.
I agree. What was in the box?
Pears.
Pears?
Pears. Quite a lot of them. Then shortly after, one of my friends in New York sent me a copy of, in Washington sent me a copy, I think it's the Washington Post, that published a whole page about this man's activities in the city of Washington and reclaiming old, decrepit apartment buildings, rebuilding them and renting them out to people who were not able to finance them themselves. I have that at home, I think, that whole page.
So you sort of have kept a little bit track of him one way or another.
But you know, I've never had any letters from him or haven't had any direct contact with him. I swore the next time I go to Washington, I'm going to look him up. He built a house out on the west side of Madison. Everything was in duplicate. He had two kitchens. Everything in the kitchens were in duplicate. He had two television sets, colored television sets when they were rare and expensive. He had two heating plants. He had two grand pianos.
He had two houses?
he had everything. We didn't know that anything was brewing particularly until one morning he was driving out of town and he stopped in at our house and left his cat with us. He says, "You keep the cat," and disappeared. That's the last we've seen of him.
That is a bit strange.
Oh, we had a few things of that kind happen.
Well, in terms of department...
Oh, one of the very amusing problems we had was I came over one morning and found a case of beer in front of the door down the second floor. Bottled beer. At that time, it was against the rules of the university to have any intoxicating liquors on the campus. Well, we didn't know what to do with this case of beer. We called up Buildings and Grounds. They didn't want to touch it. We called up the president's office. They didn't know what to do with it. We talked to everybody in the university who had any interest whatever in getting rid of this case of beer. That's what we wanted to do with it. So we struggled around here for 2 or 3 days. Then we finally adopted a plan which worked.
Which was?
We hired a couple of students to come in and steal it.
Oh, my gracious.
That solved the problem of getting rid of it.
It certainly did. Well, returning to the department, I'm interested in changes in programs.
Well, they've changed quite a lot due to the fact that in the early days, the engineering students, the engineering graduates, were, as one of the deans put it, able to do things. That has been shifted pretty largely over to the theoretical and the mathematical now, that they no longer aren't called upon or no longer are able to do things with their hands as we used to expect in the early days. And so the training now is pretty largely theoretical and mathematical. And as I think I pointed out some last time, that some of the companies are finding out it takes too long to train some of these people that are coming in now, and so they're making an effort to get some of the older people who are retired back.
They find them more helpful, more useful.
There was a, well, about 25 years ago, I heard a dean make a prediction that in the future, engineers wouldn't be able to do anything. They would just do, they'd do the thinking and the calculations. But and it's just about followed out his prediction.
Do you think that this might be a kind of reversible trend? I mean, does this go in cycles in your experience?
I don't believe so. I think the Dreyfus yesterday made a statement when somebody asked him what he knew about the insurance business. And he said he knew very little, but he wasn't going in as a technician into the company. He was going in as a manager of the company. I think the same thing has happened pretty largely in a lot of the engineering where the graduates are not doing things but, manually or with their hands, but are doing the thinking and the planning up in the mathematical and theoretical areas. That's quite evident from the literature that you get and read at the present time.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking the other day about the shortage of faculty. These are all ads asking faculty jobs which are open. Just a tremendous number at the present time.
Yes.
They're going
faculty,
in.
But you said that the students are not going into to
they're going,
teaching,
into,
going into other areas.
Many of them now go to graduate school, and they, when they get out, they go into the technical side.
So you don't see that the emphasis might shift again, and
oh, I think probably it's going to.
You think it might?
It might, but you never, that's just a guess.
Well, in some areas of study, not engineering, I'm not talking about now, there does seem to be a cyclical change that takes place eventually. The stress is on research for a while, and then it's on
I was in a meeting one time when somebody in the audience asked this chap, who I think he was a chemist, some question. He wanted a specific answer. And the man said, well, I can tell you what was true yesterday. But what is true today, I don't know. There's been so much progress made overnight.
I see. So that's the way things are.
And this is true of all schools. The faculty complain now that there's too little attention given to teaching, that everybody has now become research-minded, and I think it's true that in bringing new faculty into the institutions, the amount of money they can get come along with them in the form of grants, research grants, and that sort of thing is increased tremendously. I was talking to one of my friends about a chap who was applying for a job down at the University of Iowa. He said the dean has to have only one classification, only one qualification. Now, how much money can he bring into the university? And there's still a lot of complaint about the lack of good teaching in the part of some of the instructors. I don't think it's quite as prevalent here as it is in some of the other colleges and the university, but you find that everywhere. All they're interested in now is a lot of them. This isn't true of everybody, but some of them are interested in some sort of a project which will permit them to publish something and get promoted. And you remember that old slogan, publish or perish.
Oh yes, I've heard it many times. You believe there's truth to that?
Oh, I think there's in all institutions. See, when I look at some of these classrooms and see some of these teaching assistants they have, I wonder why the students don't know the names of the instructors. We have students here that don't know the names of the instructors. And certainly the instructors don't know the names of the students.
You're thinking of the senior faculty now, aren't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They probably know their TAs.
I was brought up in the wrong philosophy. I went to a school where the freshmen were taught by the full ranked faculty. And that's true today in an institution. The best teachers in the institution teach the freshmen, sophomore.
Well, it's my impression that that happened more or less here early.
It did.
But it's one of the changes that has gone with tremendous growth of the institution.
That's right, and lack of finances. I don't think we're getting the best men into teaching anymore.
They're going into industry?
Going into industry or going into research. There's a... I heard a university president some time ago said that one of his great ambitions while he was president was to get the salary of the faculty up to the point where the students leaving now are receiving. That's in engineering. He said the students going out now, students graduating and going out, are starting at higher salaries than most of the faculty get. That's, I think, been one of the difficulties.
So this takes them away from teaching careers.
It does.
Well, I was going to ask you about the job situation today for graduates. I assume it's good.
It's dropping off.
Why is that?
Well, I read a little comment here the other day that some of the companies are going back looking for the older engineers now because, as he said, the younger boys can't cut the mustard.
And this is because of inadequate teaching that they've received?
I don't
received?
Know what the particular reason of it, but they're starting these kids in at $25,000, $26,000 a year. Kids just out of the high school 4 years. You go here 4 years and they go out and pay them these fabulous salaries that with kids having little or no experience. Of course, that probably is due to the fact that some of the boys try to take the engineering curriculum and they can't absorb it.
Well, I guess I've become aware that the school is terribly well applied to, that you have no problem of recruiting students.
Oh, I should say not. There was a time when we had to recruit students. We had as a part of our public relations committee activity, we had a crew of six or seven people we sent all over the state. When Dean Withey was dean, he used to go out with us. We'd go into the high schools, tell them the story of engineering, and it was really a recruiting program. And it worked.
Seems to have, judging by today's figures.
It worked.
Well, you said a few minutes ago that institutions were in need of engineering faculty. So if more students, more engineering graduates were interested in teaching, they'd have fair prospects, wouldn't they? Although salaries would be somewhat less.
Well, this, everybody now is money-minded. And these students are the same way. I was with a group of students at the University of Illinois some time ago. And I just happened to get at the table with them down at one of our meetings. And they were discussing whether they should take, one boy was discussing whether he should take a job that he didn't particularly like at $24,000 a year. Or should he take one that he liked better for $22,000 a year? Now, he was wondering whether that $2,000 difference was worthwhile in having him do something he didn't like in preference to something he didn't like.
What did he decide?
He hadn't decided when we left.
Well,
I've visited practically every engineering college in the country. And I still know a lot of the faculty people in these institutions. So I get a sort of a bird's eye view of what's going on outside. Of course, as these people get older and die off, the number of people you know decreases very materially.
Yes. Well, getting back to programs, what kinds of changes have taken place?
Well, there's a fundamental change, I think, if you want to put in a few words. There was a time when an engineering graduate had to be able to go out and do things. And that had reference, I think, to his ability to go out and carry out certain mechanical operations, which now pretty largely taken care of by the engineering technicians. The curriculum is made up more on a theoretical and mathematical basis now. I had an instructor stop me here in the hall some time ago and asked me a question which any engineering student almost of years ago would know about. He never heard of it. Because they're becoming mathematically, theoretically, and research-minded. Not that those aren't qualities which every teacher should have, but I think when they overbalance it, it causes some difficulty to the students. I think you'll find that in all engineering colleges now, with few exceptions.
Well, this may account for greater interest in research.
Well, that's right. There's no reason why they shouldn't do that. That is, we need a lot of research if we're going to compete in the world, and if we don't do it, we're going to slip behind. A lot of things have come out of this institution which have material value. In the early day, we had a man here who was interested in insulation, asbestos insulation at those times. He started, the whole insulation business in the United States. He did that over in the old engineering building. So a lot of things, and with his work on concrete beams is, I think, a sort of a monumental contribution. And Wisconsin has a lot of things of which they can be proud. I think they got on the staff now the best lot of internal combustion engine people you'll find any place in the United States.
Oh.
I had a telephone call one day when we were looking for staff, and the first part of this was, if you're interested in hiring Mr. Jones, call him up. This is another institution. I happen to know this man. I called him up. And he agreed to quit his job and come up here. And we never even mentioned how much pay he was going to get.
Oh, why did this happen? The reputation of this university?
Was that. That was one thing. And he wanted to come to Madison. He was not an easy man to get along with, and he was having troubles down this other institution. But the years he'd been here, he had little or no trouble with him. He's an individualist.
Who is he?
Well, I'm not going to mention his name.
All right.
I had a report one day, the student had forged my name to a document. Well, that was just typical of the things that we had to handle every day. I got the boy, and he admitted it. I said, Bill, nobody in this world knows what you did, except when you do and I do, and this people report it. And I'm going to extract a promise from you that you will never do anything of that kind again. Now, if you live up to that, we'll just forget this whole business. But if you try it again, you're going to get run into trouble. The day that boy graduated, his mother and father came in to see me. Did you know you did more for that boy than anybody else that's been down at this institution? Because you could have wrecked him and had him thrown out of this institution.
They knew about this.
They knew about it, yeah. But you had to deal with students that. At least that's the way I tried to deal with them. That's where you got your fun out of.
Well, it sounds as though you did have an impact on him.
Well, my office used to be down the other floor. And I used to have students in there sitting around the table all the time. We discussed everything under the sun. Well, thank you, Ben.
Tell me a little bit about your teaching. Did you do a lot of teaching, or did you do a lot of research?
My interest was in primarily in teaching and in what you might call the more practical applications of engineering. See, I was brought up in a railroad shop where we did things with our hands and learned to do things. I learned the machinist trade, mm-hmm. which emphasized more of the practical rather than the theoretical. Though I went to a school which was pretty largely theoretical and mathematical.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they made us take mathematics each of the 8 semesters we were in school.
Well, they did.
And they didn't accept any of our high school mathematics as such, because we had a pretty good review of all the high school mathematics the first year I was in school. Then we had math all through the 8 semesters.
Well, I've noticed that they're now teaching in high school things that certainly I didn't meet until I got to college.
Certain people get that, but they. I think there's been a real lack in teaching mathematics, physics, and chemistry to the average students.
You do? You think it's inadequate?
So I've talked to some of the staff around here, and they think, gosh, some of these freshmen are coming in are deficient in mathematics. I talked to some of the bank people. Some of these students couldn't write out an ordinary bank check.
That's incredible.
Many of them can't spell.
Well, that's a little less incredible.
Some of them can't write a decent letter.
One would think they should graduate from high school with some of those
skills.
Well,
we discovered that a number of years ago, and the English department was unable or unwilling to help us out. So we went out and we engaged two or three instructors just to teach us students to write and read properly.
It seems that that shouldn't be necessary, doesn't it?
Well, it is. It's still going.
Yes, I've heard this suggested from other areas.
It's still going.
I'm aware that it is still going.
We had a hard time finding people who were acceptable in English to do this sort of thing. We found that newspaper people were about the best that we could get. And we tried a lawyer or two. We had, I think at one time, 77 laboratory sections. But usually, and that direct answer to your question, I think most of the staff had one or two graduate students. But there was some research, particularly on combustion in internal combustion engines, which some of the men stressed quite well. And I think that was the beginning of the reputation that has been built up here for excellent research in those particular areas.
Did you have any preference? I mean, did you find you enjoyed teaching one group or the other?
I like to teach undergraduates.
Could you tell me why you like this particularly?
More like the common people.
Oh. In what way?
Well, I don't know if I can spell it out specifically, but I like the undergraduate students.
Were they more inquiring?
Well, you had more of them.
Well, that's true.
And much of my interest was in the fields that they were interested in. And so your teaching material was specific. It wasn't. Well, I had lots of graduate students in my classes. We had classes where we get graduate and undergraduates too.
Well, I was thinking of having students that working for a degree.
Yeah, they were working for degrees. But they had something that this particular course had that they wanted to get.
I see. Did you direct any theses?
Yeah, not very many. Things that emanated out of our undergraduate instruction. Mm-hmm. So I was in the power plant field where there was not too much graduate work going on.
Oh, has this changed, do you think?
No, I don't think so. Not for the people who want to go into the power plant field. Some of them might want to come back and get a master's degree, depending on the economic conditions. But I think most of the people that at the present time are going into the power field are going at the end of the four-year period.
You mean as when they finish their bachelor's?
That's right.
Are they going directly?
Directly.
Not any graduate work at all?
That's right.
Hmm.
Of course, you'll always have a lot of them going to graduate work, whether they are getting the power industry or not.
I see.
And some of the industries, of course, are now sponsoring advanced coursework for the undergraduates they employ, but they work on very specific problems. When I was working in New York, the industries had a problem of water glass breakage. That might not need much. So they set me on a job of where I visited all the power plants in New York and Brooklyn areas to write up a story about the experience they've had with water glass breakage.
In the power plant?
In the power plant.
That's curious.
Well, that was quite an interesting experience.
By water glass, just what are you talking about?
Well, on a steam generator, there's an indication of the water level in the boiler.
Uh-huh.
And that varies as the steam is produced. And this water glass is an indicator to the fireman or the operator is what the boiler water level is.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of stories been come out of the railroad business about water glasses and big boilers. But they were having a lot of trouble with the water glass breaking. See, with the water glass breaking, all the steam came out to the water glass openings. So that's just one.
I see. How did you cope with that? How was it coped with? What was
well,
the problem?
When Pyrex came along, and they have materials now which will stand the pressures go up. Pressures are very much higher now than they used to be.
So it's really a question of advancing technology.
That's right. But that was done in the plant.
Mm, I see.
That was done in the plant. And if you'll notice, some of the utilities now are sponsoring students, probably graduate students, to solve some particular, or work on some particular problem. I was on the accreditation committee of the Engineers Joint Council for a number of years. We were made up the committee which went around and inspected the schools, the physical facilities, faculty qualifications, curricula, and all that sort of thing.
It was a national committee.
Yeah, international committee.
International.
I was severely criticized. A number of institutions. For my insistence that anybody teaching a course should have done what he is, should be able to do what he's teaching about, rather than something he read out of a book. Well, that had to do with the employment of staff members. You're getting a staff member who's going to teach, you should know something about the practical application of what he's teaching about. And I've stuck to that over the years, and it's worked. And we brought some good staff members here on that basis. Some of these boys that go in now, all they know is what they read in a book. Have no practical experience. Of course, they say, well, where do I get the practical experience? Well, they got to go out and get a job. Then some of these boys deliberately go out and get a job and get experience and come back teaching. They make pretty good staff members.
So there's merit to this?
Oh, there is, no doubt about it. I made it stick a number of times.
Well, how did you feel about teaching versus research for yourself?
Well, I did very little technical research. I did some, but not very much. My primary interest was in the teaching operation. And I had several procedures which I used. I very seldom used any notes, whatever. And the students noticed that particularly, and I was interested in every single student I had in class. I wanted to know about him, all about his background, some of which I could get from the records, and some I got just talking to him. Then I got to know the parents of some of these people, and some of them I still know. I ran across a chap down at the Madison Club the other day that was an old student of mine. He was telling his and who was with him, and I was responsible for all of his ignorance. He was the chief executive officer for one of the big plants, big companies in Milwaukee, and become very wealthy, and incidentally, a good friend of mine. Teaching to me was a personal operation. It wasn't just going through the motions. I had kids coming out of my house in the middle of the night. See me, I told them in class, they ever had any trouble, come out and see me, and they did. And quite a number of them did.
These would be personal problems.
Yeah, I had any kind of problem that they had. So that was my overall aspect of teaching. I was particularly interested in the power industry, mid-air utilities and the production of power. And I think I've been responsible for getting large numbers of people into the power industry. Because I hear from them quite frequently. I had an interesting, did I tell you the experience I had with the Minister of Railways of India?
No.
Well, he came over here, spent some time, and he expressed a desire to visit one of the big power plants. So I arranged for him to go over to the Lakeside station of the Milwaukee Electric Power Company. I told him I'd go with him. And the night before we were to go over, I got a telephone call that they'd had trouble with one of their big boilers over there, and he wanted me to know that before I brought this chap over. We went over in the morning. I took him over. I drove over to the plant, and we met the officials, and he said, maybe you'd like to go down and see him replacing the tube in this boiler. So I went down there, and luckily the man down there doing a lot of the operating work down there and replacing this tube was one of our graduates. He knew me and I knew him. He called me by first name and I called him. Well, this Indian was standing there watching it. And when we were going home that night, he said, how's it come that you know these people so well? Well, I said, that chap was an old student of mine. I knew him very well. He says, you mean to tell me that a graduate of the College of Engineering has got to go down and do that kind of work on this boiler? I said, do you know if that man is in charge of this plant? He has a problem to get this plant in operation. He's the only one who knows how to do it. Said, you come tomorrow, he'll be up in his office with his white shirt on. He never got over that.
Oh.
And we had problems here with the Indian students on the machine shop. They didn't want to do anything that required manual operation.
That's curious.
And in some of the foreign countries, they hire substitutes to do that sort of work for them in the schools.
Well, this is a social
Yeah, that's right. It's a caste system over there.
Not supposed to get their hands dirty. Well, that does point up a difference between their society and ours.
It's one of these problems I can never get. I can never have solved by these Indian students. Some of them will eat freshwater fish and not saltwater fish. And some will eat saltwater fish, not freshwater fish.
I never heard of that.
I never could get them to explain that to me.
Do you suppose it has something to do with religion?
I don't know what it is. If I can find this newspaper account on this Sioux business, I'll bring it over and let you read it. I think you'd like to read it. This is a piece of interesting material.
Oh, I would. I would very much.
He was a PhD, I think, from Zurich. Maybe he didn't get his PhD until he came to MIT, but he was a very highly trained individual. And he was one of the best teachers we've ever had.
What a shame he left.
He was a double. The boys liked him.
Double shame.
So I've been out of this activity now for nearly 25 years, so I'm sort of not posting a lot of the new things.
Well, I'm more interested in the things that were less recent, just because there aren't as many people available to ask about them. I've learned that you, probably more than anyone, is familiar with the background and history of the model of the Corliss engine, which the College of Engineering has.
I think that engine is no longer here with us.
Oh, it isn't. Where did it go?
I think the state sold it.
Oh, it belonged to the state, not the university?
There's the Centennial Corliss engine, which is on display at the Philadelphia Centennial Exposition, 1876.
1876?
Mm-hmm.
It's huge.
Oh, it's a huge affair. The distinctive feature of the Corliss engine is a valve operating mechanism.
Since you have a document which tells a lot about it, I don't want you to go into all of that repetition, but I'm wondering how you came to be so interested in it.
Well, it turned out to be one of the most effective prime movers for use in power plants all over the United States.
Did this represent a significant technological change?
There were a lot of companies building Corliss engines at that time. They were slow speed, extremely efficient. I'm gonna have to read this all over again to get the main point. The essence of the valve gear was that, you see, there was a cylinder with a piston moving back and forth. And they had to have a valve mechanism to prevent the entrance of steam before it expanded, and to discharge the steam from the cylinder after it had expanded. Now, the typical valve gear, the slide valve, used to wire draw this steam as it came in. And they didn't, they had a period of cutoff. Well, that's not a very good way to explain it. The new steam coming into the cylinder didn't come in for the full length of the stroke. Just a certain amount of steam came in. Then the supply was shut off and the steam automatically expanded. In the early valve gear, the shutting off of the steam was wire drawn, which reduced the effective pressure in the cylinder during the entire stroke. And well, in the Corliss gear, the supply of steam is shut off quickly. Then the steam expands naturally down to the exhaust pressure. Now, the governing of an engine is regulated by the point of cutoff. That is, the point of cutoff means when the supply of steam to the cylinder stops. And on the Corliss, you could regulate the length of time that the steam came into the cylinder, which was the strong point it had. It was a fairly slow speed engine, but it used its steam very effectively and was most economical. They weren't too expensive to buy. They were simple to operate. They'd run for years and years and years without any difficulty. Although the one the chorus engine I had experience with used to check it up every Saturday. We'd lubricate it and clean it up and get it ready for the next week.
What were these engines primarily used for?
Driving generators, supply electricity. But you'll find them all over the state. The Milwaukee Journal, several years ago, made a survey of the Corliss engines still in operation in Wisconsin. There are quite a large number of them still in operation.
For the same purposes, I suppose.
That's right. Little sawmills and small plants always had a slow-moving Corliss engine. We used to have one down in the laboratory. And when this wave of throwing away everything that's old came on, why, I think the state sold them to, they were declared surplus. I think they went, somebody down in St. Louis picked up the Corliss, I believe. I think there's still some Corliss engines on the state heating plant. I don't know whether they're disposed of
or
not.
The old heating plant?
Mm-hmm. I think they're still down there. When John White was state power plant engineer, he did a lot of work on the engines he had down the state power plant, because he was heating the Capitol building as well as generating power for them. And the Corliss engine was quite suitable for expanding steam below atmospheric pressure. About half the power we get out of expanding steam comes below atmospheric pressure. And that means that condensing operation is always desirable in a plant where of any size you want any kind of economy. Mm-hmm. But down there they used the exhaust steam for heating the Capitol building, and they didn't re-expand it. That's a sort of a crude explanation.
Well, that's in a nutshell, so to speak. And
this is a detailed account of the Corliss engine as it was developed in Wisconsin and built in Wisconsin.
I see. Is that your only copy?
This is the only copy that I'm not sure whether the Milwaukee Library made a copy of it or not. Now, I think this is pretty largely devoted to the work at Alice Chalmers and the engines they sold around the country.
The model is in the Milwaukee Museum.
Yeah, it's a model. It's a model about that long on a base about like that.
I see.
And the boys used to run it at University expositions.
And it was a working model.
Yeah, we used to run it with the air because we didn't have any steam available and we didn't want anywhere to get burned with it. But it's a working model.
Well, I'm glad it's been kept.
It has been kept.
I was confused. I thought that when you said the state sold it, that had been sold.
Oh, no. See, we had a real life size down here. That's the one that they sold.
I see.
We preserved the model.
Good.
Carefully.
You had to watch it carefully?
Because we didn't want them to dispose of it, so we made arrangements to put it in the Milwaukee Museum. Mm-hmm. Because they were collecting a section, they were building up a section on power producing equipment, old engines. This is one of them. It's over there now.
Well, I'm glad it's been protected.
But they wanted a history, so I worked for the Wisconsin Electric Power Company. We got this history prepared.
Well, that's very interesting. Tell me a little bit about the Wisconsin Utilities Association.
Here's what I got from there.
Wisconsin Utilities Association awards this citation of merit to Benjamin George Elliott, professional engineer, educator, author, and friend, whose years of service at the University of Wisconsin as professor of mechanical engineering have helped create and maintain the high standards of the College of Engineering, who has contributed leadership and assistance to national engineering education societies, who has participated vigorously in the activities of civic and service groups, who has written technical books and papers helpful to his profession, who has been a friend and counselor to hundreds of university students, and whose patience, frankness, and understanding have won him many lasting friendships throughout his home state of Wisconsin and elsewhere in the Middle West. October 17th, 1957. That's very nice.
I just discovered that the other day. No, I work closely with them, and they're one of the fine cooperating agencies of the College of Engineering. They established a professorship over in the Electrical Engineering Department. So that was my prime interest in the state, and I work with people all over the country and connection with our companies.
So this took you traveling some?
I was brought up in a locomotive boiler almost.
There's one thing I'd like to get back to. Your mention of Mr. Sue reminded me of it. I was going to ask you about committees, but the one that comes to mind first off is that I'm aware you were on, was one, I guess during President Fred's time, on the issue of communist speakers on the campus.
I think that came up before.
Well, it may have come
President
up before.
President Fred did, if I remember.
But there was a committee appointed by President Fred to advise him on the issue of communist speakers students brought.
I think the person I ran into was Emma Goldman.
Well, you talked about her, but this would have been much later. And it was a committee appointed by President Fred on the issue of students bringing communist speakers. Dick Hartson told me
right
about
off
this.
The minute, I don't remember any specific individual that was... I remember the committee, Ira Baldwin's on that committee, Mark Ingram, I think, was, and there were three or four others that I remember. Well, that slips my mind for a minute. I don't remember the details of that too much. I remember a meeting we had over in Bascom Hall.
Well, it's not important. Are there any other university committees that you were on that you particularly remember?
When we were amputating the budget.
Oh, tell me about that.
That was, I don't recall the year of that, but I remember we met every morning at 7 o'clock over in President Fred's office. How much the reduction in salary would be, I remember, came up. I remember very distinctly who was it over in Agricultural Economics, Ray Penn. I remember he made the final motion. I don't recall exactly what it was, but I think we had a 4.5% salary reduction. And I remember we used to meet in Bascom Hall every morning at 7 o'clock. President Fred was always there to open the door for us.
Now, what do you happen to remember at what time in the morning?
Seven.
Seven, yes. Yes, he was an early riser.
He liked to get up early and get started. Or the birds did.
Well, since this was after the war, what was the necessity for reducing salaries at that particular time?
Well, I can't tell you right off the bat what that reason was. Something slipped my mind.
Well, that's understandable. Any other committees that you recall particularly?
Excepting the group we had for the College of Engineering, which I've told you about. I don't know whether we had a retirement committee or not, but I know we had a number of meetings on the retirement problem. Mark Ingram, of course, was the spark plug for that whole business. And I was on the retirement board for I don't know how many years.
Yeah.
University.
The university one.
Yeah, representative on the State Teachers Retirement Board.
What were your responsibilities? Or what were the responsibilities of the board?
We had to take all the official actions of the board. And we met once a month down the university club, which caused some trouble.
Why would it cause trouble?
Well, we had an obstreperous member from the public school system on a medicine said that it wasn't particularly proper to have the state committee meeting at the university club, into which very few public school teachers ever had the opportunity to go. She raised quite a ruckus. So it was a woman teacher. And we brought Ray Lillywhite, who's our executive secretary. He served for a number of years before he went out to California. And we had to pass judgment on all the problems that came up during the month.
Who all was on this board?
There were, I have a picture of them all. There were two people from the public school system, two from the state colleges, and two from the university.
So you covered the complete educational area. Did you find that as representatives of these different groups that you could work together?
Oh, we had a group of fine people on the retirement board. They were dedicated and they worked hard at it. And there were a lot of problems we had coming up. One problem we had was teachers' ages. We had a number of, when the teachers were young, some of them fudged their age in order to get a job. That is, if they were, they'd add 2 or 3 years to their age in order to get a job. Well, when it came to retirement, we had to stick with the date they had given us for their birth, which was older than they had, they really were. And they objected to that. Well, we had to settle those cases.